Greetings, welcome, bienvenidos, hola, aloha, ni hao, namaste, konnichiwa, bonjour, buongiorno, sawadee kurup, guten tag, ciao, weevi, va, cat, bang, half a day, chai, janendra, salam, shalom, peace, now, go vegan, peace, how, go vegan. From the left coast of the genetically mutated McNugget pharmaceutical vivisection prison killitary industrial core poor nation, in the cheese-covered post-constitutional bankster bankrupt corruptocracy mocracy criminocracy, unchallenged by media mediocrity and bias, foodborne in the USA, home of Uncle Salmonella, where they sure do eat a lot of dead animal body parts, and the Wall Street-backed corporate diet of death, disease, and destruction is shoved down your throat. This is Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. Yeah, it is, though. It's the Wall Street-backed corporate diet of death, disease, and destruction. You want to bring down Wall Street? Go vegan and see what happens, okay? Just go vegan and see what happens. Okay, so here we are now live Mondays, 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Pacific time, and just the same as it was on Sundays. I just never quite feel ready, never quite feel prepared for the show. You know, there's so much I need to study to it takes a lot of preparation to be spontaneous and. Just so much to study. And like I have a guest on today, Kent Heckenlively, who has a book, Inoculated, How Science Lost Its Soul in Autism. This is a fascinating book, and you'll want to be with us to hear about yet another scandal in our scandal-plagued society. What else is going? Yeah, I'm paying attention to everything but what I should be studying. Here's this study that I wanted to explore. Maybe I'll get to it today. The Health Advantage of a Vegan Diet: Exploring the Gut Microbiota Connection. Will I get into that? I hope so. I should have been studying it, but here I am. I'm watching YouTube. I'm watching Howard Stern in feuds that. I don't know if these feuds are happening now, if they happened years ago on YouTube. It's timeless, you know. And Howard Stern was talking about how, it's kind of worthless to be doing a podcast. And Howard says, no, you need to go work in radio, you know, if you want to make money and want to make a living. And, you know, what are you doing with a podcast? No, you go knock on doors and work your way up. But... that's how it used to be. That's what I did. I worked my way up from radio, from the smallest stations, KDOL in Mojave, California, and KXFM in Santa Maria, and then just, you know, across the country, everywhere. You name the city, I worked there. I started Z92 in Omaha and started up WQCD in New York, CD101. I was the program director of Jazzy 100 in Washington, D.C., and KIFM in San Diego, and Star 106 San Antonio, KNUA Seattle, Love 94. Apparently, I couldn't keep a job, right? So, but that was the love of my life, working at radio stations. I was the program director. I got to choose all the music that the stations would play. I hired all personnel. So it was a benevolent dictatorship. I'm realizing more and more that it is in my blood to program music on a radio station. So that's on my to-do list. I have a to-do list for 2017. And maybe if you donated to the vegan cause, to Go Vegan Radio, 501c3, you could You could help my make my dreams come true, and we could put Radio Bobby on the air. Imagine the greatest music radio station you've ever heard, never interrupted by a commercial for meat, dairy, fish, eggs, fur, wool, leather, feathers, silk. And then all the news features, everything, you know, all the features, encouraging people to be vegan for all the reasons, for the animals, for the environment, for health. So that's on my wish list, to recreate the music radio stations of my past. And I can assure you that you've never heard music stations. I'm going to work on this. I've been working on how to handle royalty fees, ASCAP, BMI, all of those. So we'll see. We'll see. You know, it's a New Year's resolution. As I enter my, well, I will have been vegan for 33 years as of the new year. So, on my to-do list, New Year's resolutions, Radio Bobby. I would like to get an environmental project started, perhaps Vegan 2020 or 2020 Vegan. See climate change clearly. Do you know that we need a 50 to 85% shift in population to veganism by 2020, or it will be too late related to climate change? Yeah, that's what we're told by the world's top climate specialists, that the only solution that we have for climate change is a shift to veganism. So here we are. You can support this radio program with a tax-deductible donation and help us keep that message going out that animal agriculture is the number one cause of climate change, responsible for at least 51% of all greenhouse gas emissions. And the only solution is a 50 to 85% population shift away from so-called livestock products to vegan by 2020. So maybe you'd like to donate to Go Vegan Radio, 501c3, and help us spread that message, the message that saves the world. Does that make this the most important radio program ever? Howard Stern, tied with Howard Stern? Vegan 2020 or 2020 Vegan, see climate change clearly. So maybe we could get that started. You can volunteer, help us get the message to the college campi, which is the plural of campus. You'd be supporting this program. It'll be our 16th anniversary in January. Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, broadcasting as heard on the Air America Radio Network and CBS and Clear Channel radio stations around the country. 16 years. I started this program when I was just a child. And we also do need funding if we are to do another World Vegan Summit and Expo, the event that we had this past July. Professor Gary Francione called the best animal rights conference he ever attended. Well, it was put on in the most grassroots of ways, and if we're to do it again, we have to raise funds, you know, we have to catch up, you know, so it's that time of year when you are being asked to donate. So I'd like, maybe you could direct the donations that you would normally direct to groups who are now promoting cage-free eggs and saying that's the way to end cruelty to animals. Is that really a good place for your donation, or is your donation for the vegan cause more important? After all, people eating cage-free eggs or corporations promising to offer cage-free eggs in 10 years or however long are only promising to kill to kill 100% of those for whom these groups are advocating. It makes no sense. In cage-free egg production, all the males are killed, you know, just after birth, in macerators, they are ground alive. All the males, all the females are mutilated. They're kept imprisoned in harsh confinement, and then they are killed. And you have so-called animal advocacy organizations going around telling you, this is our campaign, please donate. Well, please forget that. And I don't see them saying, you know, the only solution for climate change is going vegan. I don't hear that message. I don't hear that in the cage-free egg campaign message. And yet, if we are told that that's the only way to save the planet, does anything else really matter? And I'm not making this up just because I love cows and pigs and chickens. And, you know, I mean, this is the world's top climate specialist employed by the World Bank. So we're talking about Dr. Robert Goodland and Jeffrey Anhang, who tell us animal agriculture is the number one cause of climate change, and the only solution is a population shift to veganism. And I don't know, I'm sorry if I'm repetitive to say, you know, that an alternative energy infrastructure isn't the answer, even though that's what we're told. But again, that would take $35 trillion and 20 years. So get that through Republican Congress, a Republican presidency. Well, try getting that through, you know, I mean, try getting it through with the Democrats, you know, anyway. You know, no difference in parties. So, and then, you know, the Democrats, you know, so, oh, they're the great party of the environment, right? So they recognize climate change, and what's the solution? A carbon tax, you know, some Wall Street scam that will only get the bankers wealthy, and we get these climate agreements that, you know, aren't enforceable, you know, they're just voluntary, all the countries signing up. It's all meaningless. We all just have to go vegan. It solves everything. You know, I mean, and even Santa is feeling it. Santa, we get from Live Science, a report this year, Santa is sweltering. The North Pole is soaring 36 degrees above normal where Santa is. So, you know. What does it say here in Life Science? It says, let's see, it says that Santa may need to take off some of his jolly layers this Christmas. The North Pole, the northernmost portion on the globe, where Mr. Claus lives. I'm quoting directly here from Life Science, where Mr. Claus lives. Wasn't he a PhD? Isn't it Dr. Claus? No, I guess. Okay. So, anyway, what does Life Science say? Life Science says, Santa may need to take off some of his jolly layers this Christmas. Not a pretty sight. It kind of makes me gag a little to think about it, but okay. So, it says the North Pole, the northernmost point on the globe where Mr. Claus lives, is more than 36 degrees Fahrenheit, or 20 degrees Celsius, warmer than it has been in past decades, a new report finds. Moreover, the entire Arctic region that includes the North Pole is almost 13 degrees Fahrenheit warmer today than in past years, the report found. These analyses come from Sean Burkell, a research assistant professor at the University of Maine's Climate Change Institute. He updates the temperature difference for the Arctic every day on climate reality, on climate reanalyzer.org. Yeah, reanalyzer.org. Saying he hopes to raise awareness about how the Arctic is heating up overall in some places as much as 36 degrees Fahrenheit above normal. Let's see here. Probably not too good for keeping the ice sheets together, I would imagine. So anyway, does it say anything about the ice sheets in this article here? Does it say anything about ice sheets? It says, oh, ice sheets reflect the sun's energy back into space, but as ice melts, the newly exposed ocean absorbs the sun's heat instead. As the water warms, it increases water vapor, which traps heat within the Earth's atmosphere. The vapor also leads to cloud formation, which traps even more heat. And is this not like a horror story? This is a total horror story here. And again, this horror story is brought to you by consumption of meat, dairy, fish, and eggs. If you're doing it, thanks a lot. No, it's okay. We're not blaming you. We just want you to take responsibility and go vegan now. Remember, this is the radio program that has been discussing the connection of animal agriculture and climate change, and bringing you the facts, the only peer group recognized analysis of climate and animal agriculture from Robert Goodland and Jeff Anhang. And so the only solution is to go vegan. That's all that matters. We all have to go vegan. And remember, I mean, you heard it here first, right? You heard it here first. And so it's a very, very scary scenario. It's like we're living in fear, aren't we? We're living in fear. We have our politics. We have climate change. We have vaccinations, as we will discuss later in the program with Kent Heckenlively, author of Inoculated, How Science Lost Its Soul in Autism. So what? How do we get our mind off of everything giving us such fear? Let's think up some more crazy fantasy. It's crazy fantasy. So, Pizzagate, have you been following this? Okay, well, anyway, this radio show, here we are again. I've warned you against pizza. This show is perhaps the first to warn you against cheese pizza. This show has been warning you about cheese and hot dogs and hamburgers for forever. I told you they really, what are they? They're basically the diet of Satan, right? What are they? You know, flesh and blood and pus and urine. Now everybody seems to be reading about that when they look up Pizzagate. Pretty gross, the consumption of flesh and blood and pus and urine. You know, even if certified organic, right? Even if certified organic, flesh and blood and pus and urine. How do you do that anyway? How do you certify bodily secretions and excretions? It seems weird to certify such foreign substances, foreign to the human body like that. I mean, I understand for fruits and vegetables how they can be organic, but I don't know. Organic nipple drippings or organic cloaca discharge, huh? Cloaca is the, it's the chicken's dual-purpose vagina, I mean, you know, as well as being the exit point for eggs. It's also urine. So, I don't know, that doesn't seem to be the place to look for food to me. And anyway, and now, okay, so through Pizzagate, we learned that those terms, you know, cheese pizza, hot dogs, hamburgers, are code words, apparently, in the satanic, cannibalistic, child trafficking circles. Cheese pizza, cheese hot dogs, hamburgers, satanic terms, you know, pretty much what I've been calling them for years, you know. And I do regard eating our fellow earthlings, our brothers and sisters on the planet. Isn't that cannibalism? Really? Come on. I mean, we're all so alike, huh? So we're eating others who have faces too, you know. They have faces, they have mouths, like, you know, I mean, every cow and pig and chicken or lamb or turkey had a heart, right? Just like us, you know. had blood, felt pain, had eyes to see what we were doing. How is that not cannibalism? I don't get it. Doesn't make sense to me. As you eat that cannibal, give me another cannibal here. From Campbell's, cannibal. All the cows and pigs and chickens and lambs and turkeys, by the way, are all babies also. They're not adults. You can Google Pizzagate if Google hasn't censored it yet. Pretty strange. Satanic, cannibalistic child trafficking. Which also sounds like animal agriculture to me again. And apparently, supposedly the highest ranks of government infiltrated. We'll see what happens, if anything. I don't know. Then again, when you think about it, infiltrating the highest ranks of government, who could drop so many bombs anyway, right? Who could make such big weapons deals and drop thousands and thousands of bombs and create wars? Cannibalistic, satanic cult sounds about right to me. I don't know anyone, none of my friends, none of my vegan friends would ever consider dropping one bomb on anyone. So, I don't know. What kind of person do you have to be? What? You're pretty much not vegan. Anyway, I suppose there are reasons why Tolstoy, author of War and Peace, said, as long as there are slaughterhouses, there will be battlefields. And there are reasons why leading peace activists, Cindy Sheehan, Dennis Kucinich, Cesar Chavez, we're all vegan. Peace begins on your plate. So we have an interesting program today. Up next hour, Professor Gary Francione. And, I would like to thank Vegetarian House for its support of the program. Vegetarian House, a 100% vegan restaurant in San Jose, California, 520 East Santa Clara Street. Just one of the best in the world. So if you're in the Bay Area, check it out. The website is vegetarianhouse.us. Check out the menu. It is quite amazing. And if you're in the Bay Area and you need catering, if you have a social event, a business event, you want to make sure the food is great. The catering business is booming at Vegetarian House. And so is the restaurant. It's great to see it packed that way. But, we're happening. The vegan thing is happening. It either happens or we go extinct. You know what I mean? And it tastes so good. So it's like, oh, no, we're not sacrificing anything. We're not sacrificing anyone by going vegan. The food is the best. So anyway, we will continue on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, with Ken Tech and Lively coming up. He's the author of the new book. See what you think about this. Is this exposing another, monumental scandal among scandals? It's like a scandal a day in this country. Will anybody report on it? I guess we will here at Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. Oh, and you can support the program with a tax-deductible donation at goveganradio.com. Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden at goveganradio.com, on Twitter at Go Vegan Radio, Facebook Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, and thank you for listening. And we're live now, Mondays, 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Pacific time. And live can mean any sort of technical challenge, including reaching your guest. So wouldn't be the first time doing a live show. I remember in the past I had my live show in the evenings and people would sleep, you know, sleep through. They were supposed to be interviewed. I'm used to the audience sleeping through the show. I'm just not used to the guests sleeping and going, oh, sorry, I set the alarm clock, but I didn't go off. So, but we have found Kent Heckenlively. We get worried when someone's a whistleblower, Kent, you know, and then we can't reach him or her. We don't know what. We don't know what could be happening or who's pulling the plug on our show, you know, right this very moment if we're about to reveal another incredible scandal, which seems to be the case here. So joining us this week, and we apologize for the delay, but live radio, and we've happened, and Kent is with us here. Kent Heckenlively is a science teacher and an attorney and a founding contributing editor of Age of Autism. During college, he worked for U.S. Senator Pete Wilson, and in law school was a writer and editor of the school's Law Review, and spent his summers working for the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Francisco. And he is the author of the newly released book, Inoculated, How Science Lost Its Soul in Autism. So welcome to the program, Kent. How are you today?
Thanks for having me, Bob. I'm doing well.
Good, good, good. So I have been, skimming through your book, and it's actually very interesting. It's so well written. It does read like a mystery thriller, and even, you know, in the opening, just when you're setting the scene, you're creating this new fear I have now of volcanoes, which distracted me from the subject at hand, which actually is quite an amazing subject. But tell us, what is your interest in autism? What attracted you to autism? What is autism? And, you know, take us through, you know, the foundation of the story here with your book.
Yeah, so my interest in autism is personal, first of all, since I have a daughter with autism and a seizure disorder. And, when she was first diagnosed with her seizure disorder at about 10 months, and then later autism at 3 years old, you know, we heard these stories about vaccines and autism. And, you know, as my first child. So I really kind of felt like I just gotten, you know, a bad roll of the genetic dice. And then along came my son, who for reasons unconnected to autism, we had on a hypoallergenic milk formula till he was about 15 months old. And then along comes this 18-month checkup. And I actually took him to his 18-month checkup. And because I thought the doctor missed something at my daughter's 6-month checkup, he got run through a full developmental checkup, 15, 20 words, looking at me appropriately, everything perfect. He gets his shots. 3 days later, he's mute and pounding his head on the floor. And that's when I said, oh, my God, the shots did it. And luckily, I found the gluten casein-free diet within a couple days of him going mute. And I put them, both my kids, on that immediately. And after 12 days, my son said his first word again. And it took him about a year to catch up in language with his peers, about 2 years for his sensory problems to go away. And my wife's a speech therapist, so, you know, she's a trained observer of these things. And, you know, it didn't do much for my daughter, but, oh, my God, my son came back completely. And it was from that I just said, they're lying to me about the vaccines, because you could say that it was a coincidence that he stopped talking after his 18-month shots. But when he came back after I put him on the gluten casein-free diet, I just kind of said, I don't care. Until the end of my days, I'm going to get an answer to this question.
And, These days, I mean, people say, well, autism, we've heard that there's a connection to vaccines, but that was refuted, rebuked, discredited, right? So people, now I happen to oppose vaccines. They're not vegan.
Yeah, absolutely not.
Not vegan, and they seem to have some incredibly terrible ingredients in them. I think I at one point was researching, well, they were flu shots, but in this case, I think we're talking about infant shots. But I found it amazing to see, well, mercury, formaldehyde, just an amazing cocktail that you would, and you wouldn't think anybody would get well from it, but anyway,
Yeah, and so what's really interesting, what this story inoculated is about, is that the CDC, after 1998, when Dr. Andy Wakefield released his what was a case study of parents who said that their child developed autism after the MMR shot, and he did some investigation and he actually found the measles virus persisting in the gut of these children and a novel bowel disorder. The CDC undertook their own study, and it was kind of at a perfect scientific point because up to that point in the United States, the MMR was given at about 3 years old, and they were moving it down to 18
MMR is
months. So,
what? So, tell us what MMR is. MMR
MMR is
is.
measles, mumps, and rubella. So the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine was going to be given to children earlier. So they said this makes a great scientific study. So the CDC actually put together a great plan to investigate whether the earlier administration of the MMR shot was linked to increased rates of autism. And so what happened was they did the study and the results came back and they found that there was a link specifically in African American males. It was a 3.36 fold increase. There was also an increase in what they called isolated autism, which means that the children have no other problem except autism. And so what they decided to do was they decided to throw out about a third of the African American males in order to make the numbers come down, so they could say, well, it's questionable, but we say no. And one of the scientists who was involved in this was a guy named Dr. William Thompson. And the scientists of the CDC actually got together on a Saturday to throw all the files away in a garbage can. And Thompson believed that that was illegal. So he actually kept copies of all of those. Fast forward to about 2013, he contacts an autism parent and also a fellow scientist who'd been one of our representatives. And over a period of a couple weeks, reveals to him that there's been this massive cover-up at the CDC. Thompson goes so far as to turn over 10,000 documents to Congress, specifically the office of Congressman William Posey, and he is now in federal whistleblower protection. He is waiting to be called by the House Government Oversight and Reform Committee, chaired by Congressman Jason Chaffetz. So in writing this book, I'm really a straight arrow. You can kind of see from my background, I'm a goody two shoes kind of guy. I'm not a renegade. So in writing this book, what did I do? I applied to the office of Congressman William Posey for access to these documents, and I got it. So I wrote the book based on the documents I got from Congress. So it really is something that everybody needs to read because, I always teach my students about, do you trust the sources that you're getting it from? I got my stuff from Congress. This is something that's currently being investigated. I wrote it in such a way that, I think it's objective and I go to the documents all the time. And it really is, it's corruption on a massive scale.
Okay, so now regarding autism, and what is autism exactly? You have a definition of it, or the effects, or what symptoms are, what?
So let me tell you, autism classically is defined as inability to make normal social connections. oftentimes about a quarter of the kids have seizures. So there's delayed development, delayed language acquisition. It really is a spectrum. So there's some people who are very mild, who they may be able to talk, you know, very clearly and make themselves understood, versus somebody like my daughter who lacks the ability to speak. So it really is a spectrum. So there's a large range.
Okay. And you're saying that there's a plague in autism now. So how do numbers compare today? Like, how have they grown over what period of time? What would you?
Well, what's really interesting is that 30 years ago, the numbers were supposed to be about 1 in 10,000. Right now, depending upon the estimates you go to, it's between 1 in 50 or 1 in 65 kids. An MIT scientist, Dr. Stephanie Seneff, has shown that if the rates continue the way they are by 2032, we'll be talking about 1 in every 2 kids having autism.
And so what has changed with the vaccination protocol then in that time? How do you connect
So I was born in 1963, and if you go back to 1963, you'll find that kids got about 5 vaccines, and generally they got it just before they went to school, so right before they went to kindergarten. In the 80s, they were getting maybe 15 shots, still with the majority of those around 4 to 5 years old. Now it's up around 49 to 50 shots, with about 20 of those coming in the first year of life. And The reason that's dangerous is because, you can go to any biology textbook and it will tell you that the immune system isn't really kind of fully developed until the age of 3 years old. So why are we giving all these immunizations to children whose immune system is not yet developed? It's crazy. And what I believe is happening is it's causing the immune system to become completely misguided. It's causing the creation of abnormal antibodies, which are attacking the brains of these kids. And, it's just creating an autoimmune storm.
That's a tremendous increase. If you're saying it was 1 in 10,000 and now something like 1 in 50. And then what was the connection then that you made with African-American males then? What was?
Well, there was one of the things that seems to happen is that vitamin D, which is the vitamin that you get from sunshine, seems to provide some protection if you get toxins in your body. If you're African-American and you're living in North America, you're not exposed to the same amount of sunlight as you would be if you were in Africa. Also, males have testosterone, which seems to also, which makes us kind of weak, our immune system weaker. And when it gets exposed to things like mercury or aluminum, may be more deadly. So autism has a 4-to-1 male to female ratio. So there are 4 times more males affected with autism than females.
Okay. And how many more African-Americans would you say?
It's an interesting question. So the autism parent and scientist who Dr. Thompson revealed this to is a guy named Dr. Brian Hooker. He's a professor at Simpson University in Redding, California. And he has talked about how it seems that African Americans seem to have autism at rates of about 1.5 to 2 times Caucasians.
Okay. A little bit about the history of legislation and protection of the pharmaceutical industry. I think it's quite amazing that, whose children are we anyway? Are we children of the state to be inoculated? It's pretty invasive, isn't it, to have this right?
It is. And, with my background as an attorney, what I kind of looked at is where did all of this go wrong? And I trace it to a law that was passed in 1986. And it's actually called the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act. Now, it's really funny that we have that, because when you say, oh, my kid was injured by a vaccine, they treat you like you got abducted by aliens. Well, if we had a National Alien Abduction Act, maybe those people would get a little bit more respect. And what this act did was it removed vaccines from the regular civil court system and placed it in a special vaccine court, which has very unusual rules of evidence. So let's just say you're making some vegan toast for breakfast and the toaster catches fire and burns down your kitchen. Well, you can sue the manufacturer of the toaster and you can get the records of how many complaints there have been about toasters catching fire. You can depose the engineers who built the toaster. You can't do anything like that. The pharmaceutical companies are completely immune to suit. What happened is they slapped a 75-cent tax on every single vaccine, and this goes into a special fund, and you have to apply to the federal government for coverage, for damages. And it was really interesting because I went and I interviewed actually one of the chief justices of this court. They're called special masters, as well as the Stanford law professor who'd studied the court. And both of them said the court wasn't working. It wasn't delivering justice in the way it was meant to. So we have this terrible system that isn't working. And as a result, millions of children are being put at risk and injured, you know, every year.
So the pharmaceutical companies are not liable. They're protected. They're the only one with immunity right here. They're the one, you know, the kids aren't becoming immune to disease, but they're immune, right? So
absolutely. So it really is terrible because, you know, what I jokingly say is, you know, 25 years before we decided that we weren't going to give terrorists a fair trial, we decided that we would take away the right to a fair trial for children in this country. And I find that, you know, an absolute shame.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Kent Heckenlively, the author of the new book, Inoculated, How Science Lost Its Soul in Autism. And so tell us a bit about how this unfolded. I mean, you're in the role of a whistleblower. So again, what doctors revealed what to whom and the documentation, because people are going to say, well, you know, we've heard this about autism and, you know, it's been rebuked. But again, the depth of the documentation that you have and what is it saying? Like, it's like WikiLeaks. So, you know, like what are some of the main points that would leak from these documents to convince people of this association of the vaccines? And
it was just simply when they went and they looked at the numbers and they compared it to when they gave the vaccine at a later date, the numbers just, you know, in a court of law, any increase of over 2.0 is considered de facto proof, okay? So these numbers were 3.36. And what is important for people to remember is that we're not just talking about kids who got the MMR shot and kids who didn't. We're talking about those who got it at 18 months and 36 months. It's kind of like saying, okay, let's look at lung cancer rates between somebody who smoked a pack of cigarettes a day and two packs of cigarettes a day. You know, I'm a science teacher. I teach that, you know, you got to have that control. You got to have the people who didn't smoke. You need to have the people who didn't get the MMR shot. And so the Thompson turned over more than 10,000 documents, which detail the conspiracy. He wrote a 6-page confession showing who was in the chain, who was saying, don't let this get out, who was in the chain of saying, let's delay this as long as we can, let's say this. And it's just, it's, you know, I've been at this for 15 years because I knew that it didn't make sense. And I thought I was, you know, as cynical as I could be. And I thought that it was just that they didn't want to look. And you find a whole nother level that they looked and they decided to hide the truth. And I find that truly evil. I can't come up with a better word than that, but I think it's evil when you conceal harm to children.
So does anybody know about this? I mean, are we exposing this here? Yes. But is anybody picking up on it? Are there anybody else in the media?
Well, there is a great movie that's out now, a documentary about this, because what Dr. Brian Hooker did was he recorded several conversations with William Thompson, the whistleblower, and that forms the basis of this documentary movie called Baxxed, From Cover Up to Catastrophe, that any of your listeners can go and order on Amazon. It's played around the country. It's now in contention for an Oscar nomination. You know, it's in contention. You know, we don't know if it's going to get nominated, but it's been seen by more than 60,000 people across the country, and they're having showings of it. And, you know, this, my book is really kind of a companion piece to that movie. And so we're trying to get the word out.
So this is a cover up at the Centers for Disease Control, with actual secret meetings and a whole conspiracy to hide the truth from the public.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting, because actually some of our activists went and met with Congressman Jason Chaffetz in August of this year, and Chaffetz had said, we are investigating it, and we brought up the fact that, hey, when the water was poisoned in Flint, Michigan, you guys had the officials there within a month, and Chaffetz's response was, well, actually, we've been investigating them for more than a year before the story ever broke. So I kind of think that now is the time that we are getting loud, so that, you know, when a new administration, a new Congress takes over, you know, we want to hold their feet to the fire and let them know this story has to get out there. The story has to be told. This has to be investigated.
Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, you do have something about Trump in your book, don't you? Don't you have Trump yeah. meets Dr. Wakefield?
So it had been really interesting. So we had known probably in about 2012, there's a guy named Dr. Gary Kompothrakis. He's a well-known chiropractor in Florida, and he's founded a series of clinics, and it's called Ask Gary, and kind of brings a lot of medical professionals together to help people who've been injured in auto accidents. And he's got two autistic kids. And starting about 2012, he started talking to Trump about it. And Trump, like many people, have heard these stories from, you know, friends of theirs, you know, who they've known all their lives. And, you know, we're all telling the same story. And Trump, to his credit, you know, listened to them. And he has, August 11th of 2016, he met Dr. Andy Wakefield and some other autism advocates in Timisee, Florida, for a meeting that lasted a little under an hour. And we shared with him this story, and we shared with him the documentary Vaxxed, and we asked him specifically if he would watch it, and he promised that he would. And he said that if he won, he would have us have more meetings. And so, you know, as much as anybody trusts a politician, which I don't, you know, we try to get meetings with everybody. We try to get meetings with Bernie Sanders. We try to get meetings with Hillary Clinton. None of them would talk to us, even though one of the people who's been fighting this battle the most over the years has been Robert Kennedy Jr., who's just an absolute star. And he said he tried to get Bernie Sanders to talk about this, and, you know, Bernie Sanders wouldn't. So it's unfortunate.
Why not?
That
is it. Follow the money, and the pharmaceutical companies are so rich and in control.
It's kind of funny. I wish I knew, because for all of the things that Bernie Sanders has said that I really liked, I would have thought that this would have been just kind of a natural thing for him. But you know, we've been disappointed.
It's really too bad we have to depend on politicians, because
Well, and part of what I'm doing is I'm just saying I'm going to try and make this story so hot that they have to deal with us. So, you know, one of my friends said, "Oh, you talked about Trump meeting with you. You must like him." And I said, "Well, I either like him or I'm going to make myself his biggest enemy because I really don't care. I
right.
care.
And as far as I'm concerned, it's like, well, if Trump is going to keep us out of a war with Russia and Hillary wants war with Russia, it's not that I like Trump. I just don't want nuclear bombs falling on my head. You know, it's not, like, if we can get something good out of him, let's go for it. And, you know, the children, I mean, look at the statistics you bring up, though. I mean, that's what's really amazing. If you're saying one out of 50 children now, and it was one out of 10,000, you know, just some years back. And, oh, and somebody else was mentioned, somebody whom I didn't think I respected in hearing his name again from the past. What is it? John Bolton has been mentioned for the Trump administration. And he was somebody who was sympathetic to the cause of,
it was really interesting to go back into the history of when this 1986 National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act was passed and, you know, look at the legislation. And it was interesting because the Justice Department under Reagan didn't like this bill. They suggested he not sign it. And the guy who wrote the brief was John Bolton. And it was kind of interesting because Reagan, even when he signed it, he said, I'm signing this bill with significant and serious reservations as to the constitutionality of it, because it doesn't seem like it has a proper system of checks and balances. But I'm hopeful that the next Congress will fix that. And they never did. But it's kind of funny because now it's, you know, I feel like I'm going up against motherhood when I'm going up against vaccines. And I'm saying, hey, will you look at the record here? You know,
sure.
This was a close-run thing when it passed.
And motherhood demands that, you know, we look at these things. If we want to be good mothers, right, we want to take care of the kids, let's be open to it. And, you know, what's always been shocking to me is the ingredient mercury in vaccines. Like, isn't that like right from the start, like, you know, like, hey, what does that say? Like, doesn't that, like, it's a non-starter. Hey, it has mercury in it. Should we be putting this into children?
Well, and it's like you look at the other things because, you know, we're taught as parents, okay, to be a good parent, look at what you're putting in your kid. Well, let's look at what's in the ingredients in vaccines. Okay, so you got the mercury, you got aluminum, you have often aborted fetal human cells, you have animal cells. So, you know, if you're a vegan, I just don't understand how you can take a vaccine. You know, if you're Muslim, well, a lot of them are grown in pig cells, so you're injecting pig cells into Muslims. You know, if you're Catholic and you're pro-life, how can you take a vaccine when you know it's grown in aborted human fetal cells? You know, that's just the moral issue. I think there are very, you know, strong scientific arguments that, hey, putting animal cells into your bloodstream is probably not a good idea. Putting aborted human fetal tissue into your bloodstream is not a good idea, you know, regardless of, you know, what you feel philosophically. I just think scientifically it's a recipe for disaster.
Definitely, definitely. So where do we go from here then? Like, what do you think the solution is, or what do you want to have happen?
What I want to have happen is I want people to go and buy my book and read it. I want them to go and watch Vaxxed from Cover Up to Catastrophe. I want them to demand
that
Congress.
Was that VAXX? Is that what you said? Was that what?
Yeah, VAXXED. I think that demand that Congressman Chaffetz call the whistleblower and demand that the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act be repealed. And I think those would be great steps.
Okay. And so how do people get your book? It's Inoculated, How Science Lost Its Soul in Autism, Kent Heckenlively. How do people get it?
Go and get it on Amazon. You can also check out our website, inoculated.org, to get more information about it.
Inoculated.org. Okay. Anything we missed that you wanted to mention, or?
You know, Bob, just thank you so much for having me on and for your listeners. I think that I know that you guys have been aware of how the animal agricultural industry has corrupted a lot of science, and I think this is an even greater corruption. So we should all join together and fight in the struggle for truth.
Yeah, definitely. So, I notice how influenced it is. I don't know. Are you teaching science now in school? Do you have classes with students? Do you talk about climate change at all? Or?
Absolutely.
Okay. Because animal agriculture has affected the numbers. Like, I use the study from Goodland and Anhang that says animal agriculture is responsible for at least 51% of all greenhouse gas emissions. And a lot of people use the UN FAO, Food and Agriculture Organization, which some years ago said 18%. Now it lowered it to 14%. But it's a livestock organization. If you look behind the scenes and see who's affecting the numbers, you know, it's like, where's the science there? Well, we feel 18 was too much, even though that's more than all transportation combined, and it really should be at least 51%. I guess science can be influenced by the political dollars, you know, and as the media are. So it's nice to get the truth, and thanks for your work. So, okay, again, the book, Inoculated, How Science Lost Its Soul in Autism. Kent Heck and Lively, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden at goveganradio.com, on Twitter at Go Vegan Radio, Facebook, Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. You can support our program with a tax-deductible donation. Where else do you hear about all the scandals here? The scandals with vaccines and Pizzagate and hot dogs and... Okay, we will continue. Let's see if we can reach Professor Gary Francione. It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. There's a donate button at goveganradio.com. Continue on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden at goveganradio.com, on Twitter at Go Vegan Radio, and Facebook, Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. Our thanks for support of the program to Evolution Dog and Cat Food, vegan dog and cat food. Daisy loves her Evolution. Check it out. You can order at petfoodshop.com. Yes, your companion animal family members.
Vegan too.
So Evolution, petfoodshop.com, and also the Stanford Inn, the one and only vegan eco resort in the USA. Go to stanfordinn.com, check out the rooms and the activities. And again, I'll have to take Daisy there. Your companion animal family members are welcome at the Stanford Inn, stanfordinn.com. And we are enjoying Health Aid Kombucha, cold pressed, handcrafted in small batches using only the freshest organic and raw ingredients, flavored with cold pressed juice, fermented 100% in glass and packaged in UV protected amber bottles. Vegan, organic, raw, kosher, all the good stuff on the label from Health Aid Kombucha, and it really tastes good. So now it is time for our weekly commentary with Professor Gary Francione. Is Professor Charlton with us tonight, Gary? Or
she is not presently, but she may wander in. It's unclear, but she may wander in. She's off doing something else right now, and when she finishes up, she may come in. But in any event, so it's good to be back with you, Bob. And I wanted to tell you that last night Anna and I did our first webinar. You know, we got this webinar program. And it was way too complicated for me. So Ben McKellen, who actually he did not attend the World Vegan Summit, the second one, which precedes, which will precede the third one that you'll be doing next summer. And Ben did not attend the second World Vegan Summit, but he was there by video. And if you recall, he gave that talk that I think a lot of people found very moving. But he's pretty good with this technical stuff. I am not. And I'm not kidding you. When I got the when I got the program or whatever you call this webinar thing, I couldn't really even understand the basic instructions. So I
Well, that's how I am with my Ben in Tucson, Arizona, who, you know, I have one computer here and he controls the whole thing, and he's taught me two buttons to push right now. So I'm learning right now. I'm on the advanced learning scale. I'm up to two buttons I know how to use, and we'll see how much more advanced I get in the future. But
yeah, well, I'm not even there.
You're not even at the first or second button yet.
So Ben McKellen offered to set the thing up and run it, which he did, and we had over 500 people registered for it, and it was really quite, it was phenomenal. It was absolutely phenomenal. And the way it works is, you know, I see Ben and Ben sees us and we're talking to him, but on the right hand side there's sort of like this column of comments that are coming in, and you've got 500 people sitting there and the comments were coming in just obviously it would have been great to answer everything that was coming in, but you can't when there are 500 people. And so we had to choose some questions to answer. And but it was and he was doing that. I wasn't. But it was really quite interesting. And I think that the one thing that's clear to me, Bob, and Anna and I were talking about this after the webinar. The one thing that's really clear is this is something that people are really it's an idea whose time has come. Probably it's been around for a while in terms of.
The time came 30 years ago. When I went vegan, I thought the time came.
But it's really interesting because people are really responding to this. You know, the point that we tried to make because we were asked what was the motivation for writing Eat Like You Care, and the answer was, well, we had this really, you know, we had this idea that most people already agree with everything they need to agree with to go vegan. They already recognize that it's wrong. They recognize that animals have moral value, and they recognize that it's wrong to treat animals as things or as resources. And that's all you have to believe to conclude that you have an obligation to stop eating them, wearing them, and using them. Indeed, you can't exploit them. Even with that simple concept, which contains no reference to rights, you can't use them in any situation. The only situation in which you could possibly use them is in a situation where there is a compulsion or there's some real necessity. And then you need to write that. Then you need to start talking about animal rights. But the only use of animals that we make that isn't transparently frivolous is the use of animals to cure serious human illnesses. And now, you know, we don't think that's right either, but that requires a bit more of a conversation. But using animals for food or clothing or entertainment or whatever is by definition transparently frivolous and already runs afoul of what most people believe. And so we talked about that. And it was really interesting because I was watching the comments as they were coming down the column on the right hand side of the screen, and a lot of people were acknowledging that that's exactly the experience they've had in talking with people and using this approach that we present in Eat Like You Care, that people really respond to it, and it's such a simple idea. It really is such a simple idea. And, we really do need to get people away from this idea that we need to, we need to make treatment more humane. It's never going to be done. It can never be done. It's impossible for it to be done because animals are property. And so we will never, ever really protect their interests in any significant way, assuming that you even could if you're going to use them in those ways. But I mean, obviously we could treat them a whole lot better, but we will never do that because it would cost way too much money. And the only people, only a small number of people could afford animal products produced that way. It would still be wrong. But we're never going to protect their interests in any way so that any large number of people can consume animals. And it's just so incredibly wrong to say that the issue is the treatment of animals when it's the use of animals that can't be morally justified. And so,
and it's wrong,
you know,
it's wrong right from impregnation, right? I mean, it's like,
oh, sure,
it starts off totally wrong. So
yeah, absolutely, the institution itself is wrong. However, it's done in the same way that there were some slave owners that were relatively, that treated their slaves in a better way than other slave owners who were very brutal. But the institution itself was fundamentally immoral. That was the abolitionist recognition, was that the institution itself was immoral. And it didn't matter. Obviously, the more harm you inflicted, the worse it was, but you couldn't justify it however supposedly humane it was. You just can't do that. And it's a problem of the institution itself being wrong. But I was just, and Anna and I were just overwhelmed with the response that we were getting, and how excited people were. And we've decided we're going to do these things. We're going to try to do one a month and talk about different vegan topics. We hope that you'll join us for one of these things and talk with people about vegan advocacy, because I think in many ways Anna and I and you have been approaching this as really a matter of grassroots education for a long time. Unfortunately, as far as the movement is concerned, there aren't a whole lot of us out there who have been approaching it as a matter of grassroots education, as opposed to what is done by the large groups. But I think that that's growing, Bob. I think that that's growing as a result of the efforts that we're all putting forward, and the energy at the World Vegan Summit too, which was the one that happened last summer, preceding the one that's going to happen next summer, the energy there was just palpable. I mean, it really was. I mean, you were running around doing the things that organizers do for those sorts of events, but the excitement.
And who did you say was organizing the one for next summer?
You and your large staff. There is that large staff of people. But the excitement there was palpable, and you could feel it, and you could feel it in a way that I've only been to one supposed so-called animal rights national conference, and that was in 2013. I mean, I've been to a million of those things in the 90s and in the 80s, but I've only been to the AR 2013 in the past decade or more. And the energy level at World Vegan Summit too, the energy was different because people were really excited about, they were excited about an idea, and they felt it was wonderful to see them feel empowered that they were going to go out and they were going to do things themselves. They were going to go out and they were going to educate, as opposed to the so-called animal rights national conference, where what people are doing is going to adulate and praise the leaders who are going to do the work, as long as you give them the donations. And it's just different.
How can you feel good when a conference centers on, hey, now we're going to go out and sell cage-free eggs. Hey, now we're going to go out and sell cultured lab meat. I mean, that can't make you feel good, you know, from the heart as an activist or animal advocate.
No, I don't think it does. And I think that it really is very, I don't think it does make people feel good. And I think that, you know, the summit was just a different experience from what those conferences are like. I mean, those conferences are basically advertising events for the large groups. They're fundraising events for the large groups. And they're, you know, they're places where these large organizations go to, you know, basically recruit more members, by which is meant recruit more people who donate to them. And there's never any sense of empowering those people to do anything other than to provide free labor for these large organizations. And, you know, whereas at the summit, people were really, I think, excited about their own efforts, about going out there and doing it themselves, that they, you know, they had the sense of, you know, I gave that talk about the sense of responsibility that we all have. And I have to tell you that the number of comments I got after that about, you know, about people saying, yes, you know, this is what we feel as well. This, you know, people expressing the idea that this is what they believe, that this is a moral obligation that we have to do this ourselves. It's not a matter of writing a check to somebody and doing, you know, having them do it, but rather, you know, it's Anna has just walked in. Anna, say at least say hello to Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hello, Bob. And yes.
Hi, Anna. How are you today?
Fine, thank you.
Yeah, So
you were just saying, yeah, it's not about writing a check. So please write a check to Go Vegan Radio if you want a Third World Vegan Summit and Expo. It's not about writing a check, unless you write it to Go Vegan Radio. If I'm trying to get everybody, like, who would normally donate to a group that promotes cage-free eggs, donate to Go Vegan Radio this year. They have their $2.5 million. They're paid off. I still have debt from World Vegan Summit 2. I want to do World Vegan Summit 3. But again, it's something that comes with a big financial investment and challenge and risk, it seems. So that's what, you know, that's what holds me back, the mechanism, you know, where, I don't know, look at all the money, like HSUS, like what, they have $130 million a year, $200 million in the bank, and they just laid off 55 employees because of a $20 million shortfall, which they probably
You pay much more attention to those people than I do, because I actually don't think I have anything in common with them. And I know you don't either, but, I think it's you pay more attention to them.
It's theater of the absurd to me. You know,
of course it is. Of course it is. But you know what? I've been doing this so long that I've been absurded out. You know, I just have really, I mean, my absurdity level was exceeded years ago. Let me ask you.
They fired 55 people. They keep all of these bloated salaries. The big six-figure people are there. And, you know, and then they're saying, we have a $20 million shortfall, you know, and it's like, well, isn't that the money you paid to Ringling Brothers as a racketeering settlement? You know, I'm thinking,
wow.
If they can't do it, you know, how am I supposed to do it? If they're bringing in what, $130 million a year and have a couple of hundred million in the bank, and now they're pleading poverty and, you know, begging for money, and so, yeah.
So they let go.
On the internet, they have something, I think it's called Glassdoor, which I just learned about, which is former employees making comments about where they worked. And a lot of HSUS people, you know, I mean, the people who work at these places really, like, they care. They want to do something, you know what I mean? But they say the upper management, it's terrible there. But, you know, the people who are working there, you know, for low pay, really want to do something, but they're very disappointed in the situation now.
So let me ask you: they let go 50? Did you say 55 people?
Right. Yeah.
Now, wow. You know, it's amazing to me. It's amazing to me they had 55 people. I didn't know that they had 55 people to let go.
Exactly. It's like, wow, what could 55 people be doing other than counting Wayne's salary or, you know what I mean? Like doing the accounting for the executive salaries there. Yeah. And I guess some people are still left, right? So
I know. I mean, that's just amazing. That's just amazing to me. I mean, I know that a lot of these animal welfare organizations are very upset because they're concerned that the Trump administration, you know, is going to be anti-regulatory, so they're not going to be able to do this. You know, they're not going to be able to do the welfare show as effectively as they've done it in the past if there's a real retrenchment of regulation. And, that may be one positive thing about the Trump administration. Unfortunately, to the extent that it's not hospitable to animal welfare regulations, that's a good thing. To the extent that it is, that it gets rid of a lot of regulations, the few regulations we have.
Look at what we think are regulations. We say, oh, we have to, chickens don't even enjoy the benefits of the animal welfare act or whatever. I mean, what do we, regulations are a bullet in the head, you know what I mean? That's like humane. These are the regulations. So what are we, you know, what's humane anyway? A bullet in the head. That's the way to do it. That's humane.
Exactly. Well, I mean, we are living in interesting times, but you know, I actually think in many ways, I think that the animal welfare groups are going to be considerably weakened in the coming years. And that's a good thing. I mean, that's a good thing because they do so much harm. I mean, the animal groups do so much harm. It's appalling. And so, to the extent that that support for them, both from the public and in terms of governments, the government entertaining their regulatory requests and campaigns. I think that's a good thing, and I also think it's a real opportunity for the grassroots, for a grassroots rights movement, which has already started to really develop. So I think the next few years are going to be good years in terms of encouraging grassroots advocacy, and perhaps not good years for these animal welfare corporations, which would be a good thing. I mean, that would really be a very, very good thing. But wow, I'm amazed. 55 people. As I say, I did not realize they had 50. I didn't think that they had 55 people total. It just really goes to show how large what businesses they have become. You know, what businesses they have become. It really is.
Yeah.
It really
with,
is.
You know, six figure executives everywhere there. So, you know,
right, six figure executives. Yeah, six-figure executives, and they've got lots of people who are working there. And Fidel Castro and Che Guevara ousted Batista and took over Cuba with, I think, what, 23 people? and HSUS can't really get beyond, cage-free eggs with an army of people. How sad. How incredibly sad. But
when they changed positions also, Paul Shapiro switching to vice president of policy and Josh Balk becoming vice president of farm animal protection.
Is Andrew Rowan still there as the head of Humane Society International? But Humane Society International, which has its own Happy Meat label, the Humane Choice label, where you know you get products that from animals who live the life of old McDonald's farm or some nonsense like that Humane Society International promotes,
Humane Society International is a member of an international livestock federation, actually dedicated to meeting the what's it supposed to be? A 70% increased demand for so-called livestock products by 2050, and HSUS or Humane Society International is part of that, along with every cattlemen's association, dairy, egg, feed associations around the world, along with the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization at the UN, which itself is the livestock industry. So. Big business, HSI, big livestock federation member.
Well, it's shocking. But look, we're
ignore them, go vegan. That was the message of the show, anyway. It's just ignore them, go vegan, help everybody else go vegan. That's really all that matters, anyway. As far as
yes, and make sure that you sign up for the World Vegan Summit 3. Where did you say it was going to happen?
I didn't.
Yeah,
we don't have a venue yet. I'm looking around, but I, you know, at the same time, I'm going to have to figure out ways of raising funds to do it. Which, you know, every week I tell myself, okay, maybe if I hide, nobody will pressure me for this. And then you come on every week, and you're asking about the Third World Vegan Summit and Expo. So,
well, you know, it was a very good. Last summer was really that was just one of the was a marvelous event. Every minute of it, from the beginning to the end, every minute of it was quite interesting and engaging, and people would.
Well, flattery will get you everywhere. So.
Well, but I mean, it's true, Bob. It's true. I mean, I don't know anybody. I know lots of people who went, and I don't know anybody who didn't think it was just a phenomenal experience. And you know, I think people really came away it was something that was valuable. It wasn't just an entertainment event. By no means was it an entertainment event. I mean, I hope people enjoyed the sessions, but people went there to work, and they went there to really sort of push themselves and engage things on a different level. And I think it was in that sense, it was more successful than any of us probably
than anything ever.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was certainly qualitatively different. From the only thing that I remember anything like it are the conferences we did at Rutgers in the early 1990s, which were actually somewhat similar. Well, what we were trying to do was get people to do grassroots organization. Those conferences were focused more on getting people to see the relationship between human rights issues and animal rights issues, so that we could really start sort of forming a progressive animal organization that really incorporated a lot of human rights notions and a lot of progressive other progressive notions. And so it was focused on grassroots organization, but also mindful of the human rights, animal rights connection. And we had two of them. We did them. I don't think they were consecutive years. I think there was like one and then a 2-year period. And then we had another one, although I don't really remember. And they were, there were large numbers of people attended. They, you know, and they, like the World Vegan Summit, went on for a couple of days. And you're right. There are, you know, just an enormous amount of work. And we used Rutgers facilities because I'm a professor there. So we were able to use facilities, take advantage of the fact that it was a conference that one of their professors was putting on. But I have to say, they were a lot of work, but they were very, very rewarding. And I look back on them and I think, wow, those were really excellent events. I haven't been to anything like that since. And then the World Vegan Summit came along. And so I do hope there'll be another one, because I think that although the first one was excellent, the second one was in a class by itself in a lot of ways. But But anyway, so, how is
Dave? All my wealthy listeners, all my very rich listeners, take note of that. And I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what we can put together. You know.
Absolutely.
I feel the obligation to do it. So. So let's collectively make it happen. So.
Absolutely. And I'm just trying to think if there was anything else. I just wanted to share with you something we talked about in the webinar last night, that we are working on a new book. This book will deal with how to talk to people about veganism. Eat Like You Care is basically a book that we wrote not for non-vegans, but actually primarily for vegans, to try to help them sort of think about how to approach this issue with people and deal with the many objections that they get. But one of the things that we hear quite a bit from people is they don't know how to talk to people in particular circumstances. So they'd like to know, how do you approach family? What do you do with your close friends? How do you deal with other animal people who don't share, who may be involved with welfareist organizations? So we're writing a new book that is going to address, how you talk to people about veganism in these different circumstances. This is something we can all do. We just have to apply a little common sense, for example, when you go home at Thanksgiving, sitting around the table when people are eating dead animals and other products and comparing them to Nazis is not going to generally have a good effect. I think it's important to engage one's family, but while they're sitting and eating, we've had some very interesting inquiries about what some of the things that happened to people over Thanksgiving, and it really reinforced the idea that a lot of folks really just don't understand that to somebody who's consuming animals and really doesn't see the problem, comparing that person, saying to that person that person is really no different from a Nazi is really not something which is going to resonate well and lead to a good outcome. But the thing that is clear to me, and it's becoming more clear to me as time goes on, I really believe that a major, major problem, and I mentioned this, Anna and I were talking about this with you last week, that a major problem continues to be that people, even though they may on some level know that they don't need to eat animal products, they still believe that eating animal products is natural in some way, and that not eating animal products is abnormal or unnatural. And even if they're not willing to say, well, we think it's unhealthy, or we're going to get ill if we don't, they still think that optimal health and well-being depends on animal products. This is an important thing we've got to deal with in the coming years. We've really got to deal with this because it's still an idea out there, so that when your non-vegan relatives are encountering you, they're still thinking that you may be fine, you may be healthy, you may not be suffering any obvious deficiency, but they still think that you're leading an unnatural life. It's a very weird belief that there's something unnatural about it, and it's sort of tied to health, and it's just sort of tied to what optimizes the well-being of one in this world. And it's we need to do a much better job of educating.
It's complete brainwashing to believe that.
Of course it is. Of course it is, Bob. I mean, it's no different from what was happening when you and I were children. And, do you remember when we were kids, the cigarette ads on television, they used to tell you that smoking cigarettes was good for you. Do you remember that? I mean, do you remember that?
Actors who wore white coats as if they were doctors recommending.
Exactly. One of them being Ronald Reagan. Yes, exactly. One of them being Ronald Reagan. Who would have thought that he would have become president of the United States? But Ronald Reagan, if you remember, used to do those cigarette ads, and they used to advertise that some cigarettes, you know, some one brand was better for your lung health than others, that, you know, that would get rid of more bacteria or whatever nonsense they were telling us. But I mean, they were telling us that smoking cigarettes was healthy. And so, yeah, it's complete brainwashing, but that's what happens in this society. You're dealing with a multi-zillion dollar business. And so they're telling us, you know, do you remember, it wasn't when we were children, but, you know, actually it was probably only 25 or 30 years ago, but the James Garner, remember
that's
James
when we
Garner?
Were children, wasn't it? Yeah. You're right.
Yes. Okay. All right. You know, but do you remember James Garner used to do those ads about eating meat and how beef was very important, was crucial for virility for men. And as dumb as that is, and, you know, you say, how could anybody believe that? The answer is, you know what? I think a lot of men still believe if they don't eat meat, they're going to not be virile, whatever the hell that means. But they're not going to be real men. I really think a lot of guys still believe that. And
I think it's cross-cultural,
so,
also, actually.
Many cultures
have that belief.
Yeah, I know, no doubt about that. But I think that
what was it, beef, it's what's for dinner, I think. Was that what it was?
It was a very explicit message about how beef was a manly food. I mean, it was a very explicit linking of virility and manliness or whatever right, nonsense yeah. with beef consumption. And I think that, you know, that idea, you know, those sorts of, that sort of stuff is still percolating and, you know, still part of people's background noise in their heads. And it's really quite remarkable because you're not right. You know, you're not really writing on a blank slate. You're dealing with people who believe that this is on some level a necessary form of, you know, that there's a difference between Michael Vick, who kills animals because he enjoys, you know, who participates in dogfighting because he enjoyed it, and people who eat animals. And when I say, well, they're doing that for, you know, their justification is no better than Michael Vick's because they're simply engaging in consuming animals for the purpose of pleasure, palate pleasure. I think when people hear that, part of them says, no, that's not right. It's not just palate pleasure. There's something more that's going on there. There's a necessary form of nutrition that really can't be compared with Michael Vick's engaging in dogfighting or participating in dogfighting. And they may not say it, but I think that belief still is pretty strong. And that's an important thing that we've got to get rid of. And you know, if we're ever going to make progress, we need to debunk the hell out of that idea. We need to really debunk the hell out of the idea that optimal health is related to the consumption of animal products. It is brainwashing.
Do any of those meat eaters have cancer or heart disease or stroke or diabetes or, you know, I mean.
Exactly. I mean, there's no doubt about it. But yeah.
It's always, it runs in my family, but actually, look at what you're eating. That's what runs in your family. So.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, as I've told you before, genetically, my genes, if they, you know, if I were eating animal products, I would have cholesterol like my parents did. I would have cholesterol through the roof. As it turns out, I have extremely low cholesterol. And it's not a matter of genes, because my genes are bad in that respect. They would be, you know, I would have in my parents both, you know, lived on those cholesterol reduction medications and things like that. And you know, the only reason why I don't is my diet. I mean, it's not my genes, it's my diet. And so
everybody's genes go bad when you know, he or she eats meat, dairy, fish, and eggs. And you know, you see that when the Western diet is introduced around the world, those diseases are introduced around the world. So,
absolutely.
So, okay. Well, it looks like Daisy is saying it's time for a walk, which
all right.
Controls the schedule. So, We'll do that.
All right. Well, you go take your walk and think about the World Vegan Summit 3.
How can I not think about it? You just mentioned it. It's at the top of my mind right now. So, okay.
All right, Bob.
We'll be looking for a venue. Okay, thanks,
we'll see
Gary.
You next
we'll talk
week.
To you next
Take
week.
Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
All right. Take care, Gary. All right, and I guess that'll just about do it because Daisy wants to take a walk. So I guess we'll take a walk and we'll leave all the equipment behind. It would be very cumbersome to be walking with all this equipment down the street. So I guess we'll just end the show. Thank you for listening. Please support us with a tax-deductible donation. It is that time of year when people contribute to nonprofit organizations. Go Vegan Radio is one such organization. You can find the donate button at govegan.com. Again, thank you for listening.